KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, continuing on Saturday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Portland. December's live concert features one of the leading voices in contemporary folk and Americana, Amy Spies. Again, that's the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, Saturday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our end-of-year campaign. Help us meet our $75,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's different hues of independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. Our members continue to shine a light on community radio every time they give.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess and She, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and right now you're just tuning in for our brand new show, Once Upon a Time, and we're live in the air room, and Consuelo Miranda is going to come in just a few seconds. And remember, the air room phone number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187, and the phone lines will be open very soon. Consuelo.
Hi, everybody. This is Consuelo, and I am very glad to introduce to you to Jack Perez, who is a film director and a very polyphasetic person. He has been a director, writer, producer, professor, several years of experience, and dozens of film. We are going to talk today about the relationship between autobiography and filmmaking. I have thought, for a long time, that there is a very close relationship between the two art, literature and filmmaker. Okay, so this is Jack.
Hi.
Hi, Jack. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So let's start talking about you.
Okay.
I'm bringing.
Great.
Where were you born?
I was actually born in Massachusetts. I was born in Boston.
Yeah.
But I only lived there for a few months, and my family is really from New York City. So my father moved us back to New York City shortly after I was born.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah. So I grew up in New York, and then ultimately went to NYU Film School. And then after that, I moved straight to Los Angeles, like you're supposed to do, to get into the movie business.
Yes.
And I was in Los Angeles for 30 years. And just moved up here in 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic, which was a lot of fun. Because I got here and everything was suddenly closed. So I liken it to like going, if you go on vacation and it's like, it's raining the whole time. You stay in your hotel room. So I'm just really starting to get familiar with my new home, which is Portland.
So we congratulate you and welcome you to this wonderful city.
Thank you.
I am curious to know how this vocation started growing in you, and who was the person who inspired that, perhaps a movie director or somebody in your family.
Yeah.
And at what age you start thinking, oh, this is something I really enjoy?
Well, I had, you know, my father is a confirmed cinephile. You know, he's somebody who was a film lover. And so when I was growing up in the 70s, and this is before, you know, VCRs, or even before cable, movies would run on television, you know, and if it was on at a certain time, you had to be there to watch it. So my father wanted to make sure that I saw the important movies, and it didn't matter what time it was. So to give you an idea of how enthusiastic he was, you know, suddenly I'd be woken up at 2:30 in the morning, and he'd say, get up, get up. And I'd say, what? I think it was an emergency. He said, no, come downstairs. They're showing The Third Man. You want to see The Third Man by Carol Reed. It's on now, and it's only on now. And so he, you know, basically from the time I first started watching television, from like 7 years old, my father was continuously introducing me to all the kind of great traditional Hollywood films, classic Hollywood films, because that's what was showing on television. And then, of course, that was our connection. You know, my connection with my father was really through cinema, so that sort of fortified it. And then I realized that it was really the one thing I truly loved. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't really into sports. Of all the kind of art forms that were available, photography and movie making seemed to be the thing I gravitated towards. So I was one of those kids in the 70s. They called them Super 8 kids. So you basically grab the Super 8 movie camera that your parents used to film, you know, vacations or birthdays. And I drafted my sister into making these mini epics, you know, where inevitably she'd be, you know, I'd be pouring blood all over her head and making these little monster movies or sci-fi movies. And that's how I got started. That was sort of the transition between being a watcher and being a maker. And again, all through this period, it was all the movies themselves that were sort of fueling my interest. And it was a great cross-section of everything from, you know, gangster pictures of the 30s, like, you know, The Public Enemy, to, you know, classic detective pictures like The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep in the 40s, and then atomic mutation movies like Them and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms in the 50s, and on and on and on. I really was exposed to almost every genre. And and actually, the funny thing is, I've been very lucky in my career to have made movies in virtually every one of these genres, you know, whether it's a Western or a war film or what have you, science fiction, a horror film, I've been able to sort of play in those genres that influenced me so forcefully when I was young.
How beautiful memories, especially at that age, 8 years old, more or less, and to have your father to try to connect with you in a very subtle way, because he didn't say, I want to spend time with you. He said, come and watch the movie with me. So it was an invitation, and even at 2-4 o'clock in the morning, who cares? It was the time that he gave you. And at the same time, he was introducing to you something wonderful. I am a film lover, so I think to teach to a young boy art is the best thing a father can do. So I am very happy for you.
Thank you.
And so you start at 8 years old, and then how did progress?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think you said something very telling, because we were talking about this before we went on the air. You know, my father was a traditional Latin male father, and in that he was very it was difficult for him to be open emotionally.
Yeah.
So you bring up something very interesting, which is, rather than be sort of demonstrative, saying, you know, hugging and saying I love you and, you know, that kind of stuff, it was let me kind of do this abstractly, let me abstract my affection through this thing, which is movies. And I think that's probably, in addition to my interest, just my natural sort of gravitation toward it, that's just as powerful and an ingredient why it's so meaningful to me, because his love came through this medium. But anyway, yes, it was the next step was really deciding to make it a profession. So by the time I started getting into junior high school and high school, and I kept making movies with my friends, I realized that I should probably go to film school. That seemed like the next logical
step.
Yeah. And of course, at the time, and this is now getting into the early 80s, everyone was telling you that you had to go to USC, the University of Southern California's film school, because it was plugged into Hollywood. And if you went to USC or got into USC, you would have it, you know, basically you'd have it made. And of course, I applied to USC and I got put on the wait list, but I didn't get in. And but my second choice was, you know, in my hometown, which was New York University.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, I'll go there. And as it turned out, it actually turned out to be a much better experience, because NYU, at least at the time, was very much, here's all the tools, do whatever you want. You know, in other words, be very independent and expressive, and did not really limit the creativity of their students. Whereas USC has always been slightly more political in that it's they want you to make a certain type of movie, and only certain film makers or film students get to make movies. And it was all very much like Hollywood. And I was like, well, I can wait till I get to Hollywood to deal with the politics of Hollywood. I want to be able to try to find my voice, even that sounds pretentious, as a student. So that's what I did. And it was a wonderful 4 years where I feel like my filmmaking really went from being amateurish in my freshman year to, within a couple of years, I really started to develop. Because it was a constant, it was a two-fisted approach. Now I was being exposed to cinema that I hadn't seen. I was being exposed to world cinema. I was being exposed to Japanese cinema and Italian cinema and French cinema and German, stuff that my father hadn't introduced me to because it wasn't on television. And that was stimulating. And then I was constantly being made, as you do in school, to do these filmed assignments. So I was constantly practicing filmmaking now with a much more thoughtful and an awareness that I didn't have before about why to use certain techniques and why to move the camera and why use a certain lens and so forth. So that is the best part about any film school, is that you should be consuming as much great cinema as you can while you're making it. And those two things together really are critical for your development as a filmmaker, at least in the beginning.
Yes, listening to you, I want to go to school right now and study filmmaking, because this has been in my mind since I was a child, you. And born in Chile, as a woman, I didn't think that I have any chance.
Yeah.
And I chose to write. And I think finishing with the subject about your father, attention and time is one way to show affection.
Yes.
Sometimes there are people who say to you, I love you, this, but there are no time, no attention.
Mm.
And so it doesn't mean anything. But in his subtle way, he loves you very much, Jack.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
Thank you.
I feel strongly about that. And about your film now, mm-hmm. I have a list here that you provide. I was telling you before being on the air that I was watching Big Empty.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh.
So can you tell how you relate that movie with your life, or one episode of your life?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, since this is about autobiography and, you know, there's an old expression that they say that the film director makes the same film over and over and over again. Which really speaks to, it's something about wanting to express something that is a core part of yourself and remains elusive. It's like you want to keep expressing it because it's something about your own identity, or something that never goes away about your
obsession too.
Yeah, an obsession. Yeah. And I guess most people who are in the entertainment industry are narcissists to a certain degree, so I'm sure that plays a role. So The Big Empty was really my second feature film. And I made that in 1997. This is not to be confused with another film called The Big Empty with Jon Favreau.
Ah, okay.
Which, in fact, it was really weird. The producers of that movie called me and said, hey, do you mind if we use your title for our movie? And I never been more incensed. I was like, what do you mean you want to use my title for your movie? He's like, well, we really like the title. I'm like, well, get your own fucking title. You know, like, what do you mean? What are you talking?
You cannot say that.
Keep going.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Keep going.
Anyway, so yeah, I said get your own title, and at any rate, the situation was that I said no, I would prefer you not to have this as a title, And they did it anyway. So at any rate, we made the film in 1997, and I made it with my my creative partner, Jim McManus, who was the writer. And effectively, it was our spin on the private detective genre. We were both enamored with particularly Robert Altman's movie, The Long Goodbye, which was the film that he adapted from the Raymond Chandler novel. And what Altman did in that film was really take something very traditional, like the private eye genre, and turn it on its head and really explore areas of the story that you wouldn't get in a traditional movie, and characterizations that you wouldn't get in a traditional detective movie. So basically, that was our inspiration, and we decided to do a story that we both could relate to within the framework of a private detective movie. So that's a long way around to saying that we made a personal movie that happened to be a private detective movie.
Very good. I will remind our listener, our phone number, 503-231-8187. And also, I will remind you that this station is expecting your collaboration. We need you, and this way we can keep having these wonderful guests and this wonderful program and many others that we have every single day. There is several ways that you can contribute and collaborate with us. You can become a member, and so we need your support. And for that, you can Kibu /FM give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Okay, now I will want to know, in terms of your colleague, the director, which are the one who inspire you and make you, you already mentioned Altman, what is one of the one, yes, I like too, and what other director or kind of genre that you follow in your movies?
Well, I mean, getting back to filmmakers that inspire me. I mean, as I got older, I started to respond more directly to those filmmakers that really were making personal films, even if they were genre films. And so directors like Sam Peckinpah was an enormous influence, because I could feel his obsessions and his passions and his eccentricities, all his interests in the movies he was making, even if they were westerns or thrillers, and obviously Sam Peckinpah's technique, his visual technique, made a huge impression. Obviously, someone like Martin Scorsese was an enormous influence. I remember, you know, Taxi Driver being a movie that I would go to see at Cinema Village, which was a revival theater in Greenwich Village, over and over again. I mean, almost every month I would go to see it and study it. And that movie, Taxi Driver, not only spoke to me personally, and again, you know, that's a movie that, you know, Scorsese growing up in New York City, that's an enormously personal movie. And it's what I call a compendium film, meaning that you can almost see everything, learn everything about cinema almost through this one movie. Hmm. So Scorsese and Altman and Peckinpah and Robert Aldrich was another filmmaker that made a big impression on me, who did The Dirty Dozen and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and arguably Vera Cruz, which is arguably my favorite movie. And Hitchcock too. You know, we were talking a little bit about Hitchcock. Yeah. Hitchcock, you know, is considered one of the most, you know, the makers of popular entertainment. And really, when you look at Hitchcock's movies, his obsessions, the darkness in him is shot through virtually every movie he ever made. So that I became very aware of that idea, so that it wasn't necessary to make a literal autobiography, where the story had to be exactly what happened to you, but you could take the feelings, the emotions, the opinions that you have and work them into traditional narratives. And then it becomes something else. It doesn't just become a movie driven by plot. It becomes something more than that. That really became my primary interest. That was my goal in making movies. The difficulty is in Hollywood is that that's not necessarily what studios want to make. Studios want to make movies that are essentially entertainments first, then make money.
And lucrative.
Yes, exactly. And so I've always had sort of one foot squarely in the independent world where I can make movies, smaller movies, but more personal movies. And then when I make larger movies for the studios or for the television networks, I try to do, as we were saying before we went on air, what the old studio directors used to do, which is kind of insinuate themselves as much as they can, get as much of themselves into the movie, even though it's not readily apparent, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think also it's very hard for any artist to put aside or to build a wall that, oh, this is personal, this is my, to be objective and subjective, mm-hmm. because it's part of who you are and it's your experience. And that is the reason why it's so important to understand that autobiography is something essential in your life. In what way? If you don't recognize who your history or your story, you will not know who you are. And you don't need to be old to get to know who you are. I think it's Socrates said that long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I am not saying nothing new, but I think now there are less younger people writing to having their own diary, as I have been mentioned before. And I think that is important that you can adapt what you have seen in your life, what you have done, into your performance and your art. I think is nothing wrong with that. And enrich, because this is what, when I am reading an autobiography, I want to know how that person dealt or deal with rejection, mm-hmm. with love, mm-hmm. with the art, with the fact that sometimes you don't have anything to say and you want to write and the idea don't come to mind. Mm-hmm. And that is what we call a dry period. And it's very hard for a writer. And also the discipline that you have to have, that you have to write alone. Mm-hmm. That is almost like to watch a movie. You don't want to be disturbed. The other day I was with a friend who I love dearly, but she didn't allow me to watch Tar the way I wanted. And mm-hmm. I stopped her. I said, look, this is not TV. This is film. This is art. Allow me to do it the way I want. And don't interrupt and don't bring me more wine or water because I don't need. You see? So sometimes people don't pay attention how hard it is for the director and the actor and actresses to be into that movie and the concentration. And some people leave the theater before even the
credits.
The credit. Mm-hmm. I found that unbelievable rude.
Well, you have respect. I mean, I mean, it's like most people look at movies like water.
Entertainment.
Yeah, it's like water that comes out of the tap. It's like it's there and you're paying for it and it better amuse me and that's really the end of it. And you know, for the maker, it's obviously a much different thing. You know, there's another expression that somebody sweat blood to make the worst movie you ever saw, meaning that the junkiest, crappiest thing you ever saw, somebody broke their back to make it. And one of the things I realized early on, and this is nothing wrong with this, but I think there are journeymen filmmakers. There are people who basically look at filmmaking, and I don't understand this personally, but it's like being a carpenter. You come in and you build the house, and it doesn't matter whether there's anything personal in it. I'm just executing a plan professionally. It's like when you call someone to paint your house. It's like you're not asking them to do a mural. You're asking them to paint it professionally and cleanly. And there are filmmakers that make movies in that manner. What I learned pretty much early on when I was first starting out, I was working, the first thing I did was this pilot for a show called Xena Warrior Princess.
Yes, yes.
That was like the first show I worked on as a director, paid director. And I remember that because of my father, I did have a background in what they called sword and sandal films, and I had seen films like Jason and the Argonauts and Sinbad and things that related to the kind of fantasy movie that Xena really was. But as I was making it and realizing how much work and how much time, how much effort, I started to become acutely aware that wow, it's like to not have your personality as an ingredient, as a major ingredient in this thing, it didn't make as much sense to me. And I think that's a very shrewd observation. I at least for me, I cannot separate how passionate I am, regardless of what I do. So I put the same amount of love into something that has no meaning to me, like a pizza commercial or whatever, or a movie for television or whatever, as I'd put into a very personal movie, because I can't really, I don't know how to regulate that. It is what it is. So it fits, yeah. It's a better fit when I can apply that love to something that's personal to
because
start with.
Because you are a professional, so you don't make a distinction, and this is what. How does the director adapt a book to become a film?
I mean, it's interesting. I haven't, there's only been one project I worked on where we were really working from a published source. In many ways, I think it's easier because in many ways, the structure, you know, as a writer, you know, creating a structure, a narrative structure, forget about dialogue and characters that are dimensional. I'm just talking about a story that works.
The plot.
So the plot, in most cases, a book has already worked that out. So the spine of the screenplay, which comes next, obviously, is already pretty much intact. But I guess it depends on the material, you know. Oftentimes you end up economizing what's there. Like if you look at something, like you hear the stories about the Brian Helgeland and Curtis Hanson adapting L.A. Confidential, James Ellroy's book, and that the book is just, you know, this bursting with subplots and characters, and it's all very interesting, but film has to be a little bit more linear. So it's a lot of the time it's about paring down something to the essence of what the story is, or distilling it to the essence of the story. So I think that's part of the process, is just finding out what is necessary and what's going to work in this medium, which is different from literature.
Some way you are an interpreter.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. In fact, the director is an interpreter full stop.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like the director is somebody who takes a script, which is the written word, and translates that into what is going to be a series of images. And the script is not like a book. You can publish a script, but very few people read scripts. Scripts are the blueprint upon which the final form is made. And so a director is an interpreter of that, or a translator, really, of that.
Do you often are the script writer?
It depends. You know, like I'm a member of both the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild, and that came through having written scripts for hire and directing for hire. But honestly, I really feel that if I really look at myself honestly, I feel that I'm a stronger director than I am a writer. In other words, I think visually first. And I really think the strongest writers don't necessarily think visually first. They think they express themselves best through language, through words.
Yeah.
One of the things Scorsese always said, going back to Taxi Driver, he said, Paul Schrader could express these feelings in words that I could not express the world of Taxi Driver in words. I could express it in images and an atmosphere. So that really makes a great sort of combination when you have somebody who is really fully expressive in written language, and then somebody who is fully expressive visually. You have the best of both worlds. You know?
Yeah, it comes to my mind as Scott Fitzgerald. He tried very hard to do that, to become a scriptwriter, and he couldn't.
Yeah,
he failed completely, and being a tremendous, tremendous writer, and that period of his life was very hard, and he was fired.
Well, there's a history of great writers, great novelists, and great playwrights coming to Hollywood or being hired, given a lot of money. People like Faulkner coming to Hollywood, or even Chandler. You know, people that you think would be able to easily adapt the novel into, but screenplays are very different. Screenplays are all about economy, and there's very little internal life. What a novel does is it allows you to explore details of environment and atmosphere, and certainly what people are thinking. And movies are not about what people are thinking. Sure, there are some movies that use voiceover, but in most cases, it's about showing through action. And that's a very different kind of storytelling than what a novelist does. So I can see why it would be difficult for certain great writers of literature to somehow be restricted to writing about. If you've seen the movie Barton Fink by the Coen brothers, that's exactly what that story is about. It's about a playwright played by John Turturro coming to Hollywood to write a dumb wrestling movie, and he's just talking about being blocked. He cannot bring himself to write this thing because he doesn't know how to get into it. So, yes, it's a very common problem.
Yeah, it's a very common problem. I will encourage our listeners to have the opportunity to call and to interview, make questions to Jack Perez. He's a very interesting man, very interesting professional. So don't miss this opportunity. Our phone number is 503-231-8187. And now about, how is the industry is now? Where is going?
Well, there's a spider crawling
up in the spider
in the studio. It's
yes,
very interesting.
So that is a good luck.
Yeah,
good
very, luck. Is that a good luck thing, a spider in the studio?
I think so.
Okay, I like that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's lovely.
I don't know. I think that, you know, I've always said that I feel like if I had been born 15 years, 20 years earlier, I would have been in a much better place because the kinds of movies that I like to make were being made more frequently. In other words, the movies that were really coming out in the 70s, that really were the most formative for me as a young adult. Those are the movies I wanted to make, the movies that were not just, pop entertainments. They were character driven. They were often downbeat. They dealt with characters that were not traditional and so forth. So anyway.
Okay, do we have a call?
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm enjoying your show. I enjoy your Friday shows. Thank you. I have a comment on something that your guest just made.
Yes?
He was talking about how we don't really show thought in movies. And I wonder if he saw a very wonderful early movie by Victor Sjostrom called The Winds. In The Wind, we see a woman, I think from Chicago, who's all of a sudden put into the north part of Texas, and she's going crazy almost, being alone in the sod house with they're skinning a cow in her kitchen, and she starts, and then the northern winds come, and what the filmmaker does is he shows in the sky these Native Americans riding horses, almost her hallucinations, and we see what she's thinking visually.
Mm-hmm.
So he tells her story visually,
yes,
as well as showing her thoughts. I wonder if you've ever seen that movie.
I haven't seen that, but I think we bring up a very interesting point, which is, again, it's like in cinema, you're almost, it's much more poetic in this form to use visuals to illustrate what somebody is thinking or feeling. I was just showing to a class this week, I don't know if you've ever seen The Pawnbroker, Sidney Lumet's movie,
yeah,
The Pawnbroker, with Rod Steiger.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it was a groundbreaking use of how do you show the moment where somebody is hit with a flash of memory? How do you show somebody being struck by a sound of, say, a dog barking, and suddenly you get, you know, a quarter of a second shot of a moment from Auschwitz with a Nazi, mm-hmm, with a German shepherd, and it comes into his head. So what you're talking about is, I think, the perfect way in cinema to illustrate thought, which is to use the visual rather than to necessarily hear what somebody is, you know, so what somebody is saying about what they're thinking, you know, literally showing what they're thinking, you know.
I think Pudovkin tried that too with his use of montages to show how a person's thinking.
Absolutely.
We have someone who comes to St. Petersburg and all of a sudden he thinks of his mother, and you see on screen just his mother in their little, you know, country hut, and then we're back to him again.
Exactly, and those techniques are used to, you know, again, like you look at a modern film, and I absolutely am drawing no comparison to someone like David Fincher, to Pudovkin, but if you look at the end of something like Seven, where Brad Pitt is about to shoot the killer, and he's aiming the gun, and it's a big close-up of Brad Pitt, and for a moment he thinks of his wife, who he knows has been murdered, and again, you get just a burst, almost a subliminal burst of poor Gwyneth Paltrow's face as he remembers her, and that triggers him to pull the trigger. And so, yeah, that technique is a fascinating one, and should be the way you illustrate thought. It's a visual medium, you know.
The very fact that as human beings we have dreams, we are seeing our thoughts.
That's
and
right.
I assume that motion pictures can do the same thing.
Well,
I get spoiled that although I didn't go to film school, I was at University of Rochester, which has the George Eastman House, and they were continually showing us these unique films from their archives, you know, all these early movies.
Well, you say,
I look forward to seeing your films.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, I think the last thing I'll say, and I think you bring up a very interesting point, is that I think the reason many people have said that cinema is such the dominant art medium of our times is that the very form itself, the way movies unfold, shots cut together, actually replicate our dream state. You know, there's something about the way movies work that feel like dreams anyway. So I think that's a really astute comment.
Yeah, and to
disappointing that in motion pictures, unlike in the theater, the spectator is so much at the mercy of the director. Mm-hmm. Who's controlling and releasing information.
That's right.
Whereas theater operates with dramatic irony where we know something before the characters don't, and mm-hmm. that's often part of the story.
Yeah, that is what is wonderful. And to finish with the thought, that is a reason because the photographer is a very important part making a movie. And because the image, most of the time, are coming from the good photographer. The relationship between Berman and his photographer was extremely important in the way he developed his filmmaking. Okay, we appreciate very much your thought, question, and no doubt that you are one of us.
Yes, one
Thank
of us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. So we keep going with the... what can we tell a young filmmaker that is just he got his degree and he's a little bit lost, confused, and he wants what will be as a mentor, no a professor, as a mentor, where how will you direct his path? He has to work as a volunteer with a director, he has to...
Well, it depends. I mean, I remember running into a guy once because every filmmaker starting out wants to know what's the key, like what do I have to do to become a professional? And I remember meeting this old television director once, and he said, kid, you know, becoming a professional is like being given a box with a lock on it, and you got to find the key. And I said, yeah. And then he said, but here's the problem. Everybody's lock and everybody's key is different. I'm like, well, okay, that doesn't really help very much. The idea being that there is no exact repeatable path. No. But I do think that you know, if you're going to be a feature film director, meaning if that's your goal to be a feature film director, then you almost have to find a way to make a feature. In other words, no one's going to give you a movie, even based on, like, I came out of NYU with an award-winning short film that had won Best Director and everything. Even so, a studio is not going to go, oh, hey, kid, I think you're really talented. I saw your 20-minute movie. Here's several million dollars to make a movie. you kind of have to demonstrate to yourself, I think this is even more important, demonstrate to yourself that you are this thing. So you'll find that most filmmakers start by finding a way to make an ultra-low-budget feature film that will be not only a calling card, ultimately, for Hollywood, but also it'll show you that this is really who you are and this is what you want to do. And to your point earlier, it's about picking a subject that is intensely personal to you, something that even if it's not, again, a literal autobiography, has so much of yourself in it, because ultimately that's all you have to offer. You know, it's like it's not about technical prowess. It's not about being flashy. It's not even, it's not about slickness. It's really about what story are you telling that you deeply care about, that you know, like the DNA of this story, and that's all you really have. So it's a tricky thing. As Chaplin said, just coming up with the idea was the hardest part. So I often tell my students when they're struggling, even with an assignment, and they say, well, I don't know, if I say you go make a short film, and they say, well, what do I make a movie about? I usually say, well, look, if you don't have any ideas, start with something either you love intensely or hate intensely. Start there, because at least you're starting from a point of passion as opposed to something that's just merely curious.
It is interesting because with the writing it's almost the same. It's the analogy between when you start and the page is white mm-hmm. and you said, okay, this event is something that I need to write about it, even if the first draft is not as good as the latest, but you put there the feeling, the passion, the plot of the story, and it's a beginning. And it's enough. You don't need to do something else. And that will be the itinerary that you will follow in the story. Mm-hmm. Because like Jack said, you start for something that is important to you, that is part of who you are, and that you want to tell the world that this, I care, and you need to know this.
That's absolutely true. And also, I feel like simultaneously, whether you're in film school or not, it doesn't matter if you're in film school, is that you it's important that the young filmmaker consume, meaning watch, the great filmmakers and the great films. It's like, if you want to be a great writer, you read the great books. If you're going to be a chef, you eat, you taste the great food. You don't, there's so much to see out there. And look, I like junk entertainment as much as the next person, but you do yourself a favor and watch like if you watched one Hitchcock movie a week, just without any kind of formal education, you'd be a better filmmaker just by exposing yourself to this master of the medium. And that goes for everyone, like you said, Ingmar Bergman, Akira Kurosawa, Martin Scorsese, on and on and on. There are great filmmakers that by watching these films, you become a better filmmaker. The other thing is that if you have the opportunity and you want to be a director, then do all the roles that are the other roles. In other words, I learned cinematography, to your point about who photographs the movie. I learned camera and lenses, and I pushed a dolly, and I did everything. I recorded sound. I rigged lights. I did everything that every crew member on a movie does, because as a director, you have an idea that you need to funnel through all these individual technicians, and if you don't speak the language of those technicians, then your idea can be diluted through interpretation. And so because filmmaking, film directing is not a singular art, it's not you with a pencil or you at a typewriter, it's you with all of these crew people, knowing all of these roles and really what goes into technically making a film, specifically cinematography, meaning the photography of the film, and editing, which is really the only thing in cinema that is unique to that medium. When you look at movie making, writing scripts come from something else, acting comes from theater, going all the way back to the Greeks, music, everything else, photography, that all that stuff existed. The only thing that's unique about movies is the juxtaposition of images, the cutting together of moving images. So to understand sort of those two sort of tent poles, one is the photography of it and one is the editing of it, that in of itself makes you a strong filmmaker.
I agree. Mm-hmm. It's very important. And I will suggest the relationship, like we have been talking about, the relationship between film and autobiography. And I will start with my beloved Ingmar Bergman from Sweden. And he has a wonderful movie that I have seen a couple of times called Fanny and Alexander. Mm-hmm. There he is talking about his childhood, and God is always present, or God is not present. That is one of his main subjects. And also, I will suggest, if you can find his autobiography called The Magic Lantern. Mm. That is one of my favorite books. I adore Bergman. It had a big impression in my life. And The Magic Lantern is one way to understand much better his movie and to get to know him. Mm-hmm. Sweden is waiting for me. I will go and visit his house, who is a museum. And the other is The Four Blows by Truffaut. Mm-hmm. Oh, Truffaut, one of the wonderful French director. In this movie, he's talking about the bad boy he was. He was born in a very humble environment, and he has so many problems, and so the principal character in this movie. And then I will recommend it by Fellini, Amarcord.
Yes.
Cierto? You have something to say?
Well, no, Amarcord is, I mean, talk about an autobiographical movie, but is also like a dream, you know, like all Fellini films. It's just this beautiful poem, and that's a perfect example of a film that I hadn't seen, because that never played on television. But when I was in film school, I suddenly saw this film, and it just changed my life. So it's a wonderful movie.
Beautiful. Those encounters are beautiful. I think artists, we are born to give to the general public those encounter, and it's not enough how much. We have to say thank you. And why is so important that we have fun, and we gave fun to our station and to the art. I think it's very important. And the last one is Out of Africa.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
By Karen Flixen, Her Life in Kenya. I saw that movie too many years ago. Very impressed with the environment, the setting, how they did, and by her. And so this is a book as well as a good movie. And always the Anne Frank diary, there are many versions. And it's good. Sometimes people said, oh, the book was much better than the movie. Bueno, we have here the expert that give us already the reason why they are different, but they are compatible. They are not incompatible. And sometimes it's good to read the book first and then to go and see the movie, mm-hmm. or vice versa. I do encourage you to keep going with the research of autobiography, and perhaps after that you will be able to write your own, even if you don't publish. But as I said during my first show, you will be able to give it to your friend, families, and who knows, to the public library. That is very important. And now I will remind you one more time, become a good collaborator with our station. You can do it through just go to KBU FM dash give or text to KBOO to this number 44321. And you can still call, and will be nice if we have another call, 543-231-8187. We are here. You can make question to Jack or to me in relation to the film industry and his own movies. Which one of the one you have done is your favorite, my dear?
I guess I think there are probably three that are the most personal.
Okay.
One is The Big Empty from 1997.
Yeah.
The other one is La Cucaracha,
yeah.
which I made in 1998. And then a movie with a crazy title called Some Guy Who Kills People, which I made in 2011, which is a horror comedy family drama, if you can believe it, that was produced by John Landis, who did The Blues Brothers and Animal House and American Werewolf in London. And all the three of those films are some of the smaller films I've made, but they're the ones that have the most of me in them. So even though I've made bigger movies and maybe ones that people know more than these are the ones that I think of immediately. But what you were saying earlier about just autobiography is that, you know, for me, in addition to watching the great films, I try to read as much about the great filmmakers. So you pointed out a couple of autobiographies by Bergman's autobiography, and you know, there's a series of books. One is called Scorsese on Scorsese, which is really just a dialogue where Scorsese basically talks about all of his influences, everything in his life that happened to him, and more specifically how he addressed each one of the films and why he made the choices he made. Going back to Truffaut, there's a great book, which I'm sure you know, called Hitchcock-Truffaut, which is when the two great men sat down together, the two directors, and decided, and Truffaut as a director, decided to investigate deeply each one of Hitchcock's projects. And it's not a biography, it's a conversation between two filmmakers where you really do learn why these choices are made, what influenced them, what inspired them, and so forth. So now we have, obviously, director's commentaries on DVDs and Blu-rays, which are also a great resource. But, you know, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool filmmaker, you don't just watch the movie. You kind of put it under a magnifying glass, and you try to figure out how it comes together. Why is it working? And part of that is going right to the source, going to the filmmaker and finding out what were they thinking? Why did they make these choices? And so for me, I'm a lifelong student. Even though I'm a teacher, I'm a lifelong student of cinema.
I share that. I think the informal education is the most important. I keep telling the younger people around me, read, investigate it, what you are passionate about it, because it's what make your life worthwhile, and you will enjoy tremendously. And during the hard time that obviously you will have, like everybody else, art, a good book, a good symphony, always the Fifth of Mahler, by Mahler, and will bring you a lot of peace. Or even if you are still upset, it will give you consolation. I think this is what art is. It gives you a consolation to anything that you have been going through. And the film, after a film, you always feel, I do, I will not say always, but most of the time I feel so happy that I have been able to see something well done, perfect, to the point that I am hungry about it, and I keep watching the same movie over the years of my life and impress me tremendous. For example, it is interesting to talk about the the influence of the big director with other director. Mm-hmm. For example, Berman influenced Woody Allen in a way that tremendous. Hannah and His Sister, Interior. These are movies that when I watched it the first time, I thought, oh, this is Berman.
Crimes and Misdemeanors. To the point where he enlisted Sven Nykvist, Bergman's cinematographer, to shoot many of his films, you know. So he's literally using, you know, Bergman's key collaborator, visual collaborator, to kind of tackle his own take on Bergman. Yeah, no, that's a huge thing, you know, because when you watch the great filmmakers, you suddenly realize who you relate to, and it's a rabbit hole. It's like anything. It's like listening to a band. You're like, wow, this is a great band. What influenced them? And suddenly that takes you to something else. And it's the same thing with filmmaking. You'll find that, like, for example, I was talking about we were talking about Robert Altman. And earlier, Paul Thomas Anderson was an enormous Robert Altman fan. He was strongly, strongly influenced, to the point when Robert Altman was making his last movie, A Prairie Home Companion, and the insurance company said, he's too old, we can't really insure this movie. Paul Thomas Anderson said, you know what? I'll be on set every day as basically an understudy, and I'll sit there and I'll watch this great master at work, so that if or he takes ill, I can step in and the film will get finished. And
dedication.
And the same thing happened with Guillermo del Toro, observing the last film of William Friedkin for the same reason, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. He was there every day watching this filmmaker that changed his life, so he could continue to learn, really.
Okay, we haven't talked about the documentary.
Yes.
What can you tell us? Because I love the documentary. It's one thing I would like to make myself. And I think it's a kind of a short essay. I see the documentary almost like a short essay in sociology, religion, whatever. What is your opinion?
Well, I mean, look, when I see a great documentary, it almost makes me feel like, what's the point of watching a scripted movie? Like, when you see a great documentary that really moves you, that's, talk about truth and authenticity. I mean, everything in filmmaking is a construct, so it's not absolute truth. But a documentary is closer to the real thing because it is the real thing, at least the subject is. It's its own form. It's different from filmmaking, narrative filmmaking, where you have to script everything. With documentary, I think it's more of an investigation. Sometimes you start with an idea of what you think it's going to be, and it can completely change within the process of making it, interviewing these people, following their stories. I've seen some wonderful documentaries that are enormously influential. You know, talk about autobiography. There's a filmmaker that I saw when I was a student named Ross McElwee, who made one of his films is called Sherman's March, which is one of the most personal documentaries and the most wonderful documentaries, funny and warm and weird. And he's basically in the movie, the filmmaker himself. It's like a one-man band. He starts making a movie about William Tecumseh Sherman's march, terrible march during the Civil War. He's making a Civil War documentary, and he's going to these battlefields in the South where he grew up, and then he starts running into old girlfriends while he's making the movie, and the whole movie shifts into an exploration of why he can't. It becomes nothing about the Civil War. It's all about how he cannot sustain a romantic relationship, and the whole movie becomes about all of his troubles with women, and it's this enormously candid and real, because it's happening right in front of you. And you don't get that. You can't get that in a scripted movie.
You will have
movie.
To write the name because it's complicated
to
me.
I will.
Yeah, I think it's, like I said, research and investigation of the subject is one of the first step to anything you do in life. Mm. And then, you see, to interview you, I had to see something and read about you. And because, by the way, we met by accident.
Right.
couple of months ago, and we I am very, very pleased that I had the idea to bring you, because it has been a wonderful class. This has been a class, and I am super happy and ready to make documentary and to start working 10,000 hours per day, so this way I can pay my own documentary. And I will take the time also to say this was our fourth program. One more time, I want to thank our station, KBU, and Ender, my boss in public affairs, and myself also, because I still think that this is a good subject and we should address who we are and our experience in our life. I hope next time we will have more call, and any comment will be greatly appreciated. Mm-hmm. Thank you to life, and thank you to Portland, and thank you to everybody. Here I leave you with the music, Consuelo. Beautiful, beautiful.
There are places I remember.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, and this is probably nothing new to residents of Portland, but, you know, speaking of documentaries, and as I was saying earlier, I'm not like a sports guy, but there was a documentary in 2014, I think it still plays on Netflix, called The Battered Bastards of Baseball. And it's all about the Portland Mavericks, you know, which was the defunct minor league team here in Portland in the 70s that was founded by Bing Russell, who was Kurt Russell's father, an actor who decided to, and a lifelong baseball fanatic, who decided to form this truly independent, talk about independent, independent baseball team. That documentary is so moving, and it's particularly moving to me because it's really about, talk about the spirit of the underdog. I mean, this is a whole team, a whole group of people that were people who were discarded, people who would not be hired to play baseball, a bunch of misfits who came together and became champions. And it sounds like a classic Hollywood story, but it's absolutely true. And even though I'm not like a baseball fanatic, if you watch, you're looking for something that's inspiring and actually local, very local, the local history, The Battered Bastards of Baseball from 2014 on Netflix is a good one.
Okay, so this is everything for today. We are encourage you to tune us 1 week from today, 2 weeks more or less. And also you can repeat the program on the website. You can listen it again, and I think it will be very nice because we have had a masterpiece today, a good class about filmmaking, one of my wonderful, beloved art. See you in some way. Voice is also something that you can see and feel. Consuelo, thank you very much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes, primero de diciembre del 2023. Aumentan los llamados a extender la tregua mientras decenas de prisioneros palestinos y cautivos de Hamas son liberados. Las fuerzas israelíes matan al menos a 8 palestinos de Cisjordania en medio de un aumento de la violencia. La policía de Vermont, en Estados Unidos, arresta a un sospechoso de disparar contra